I'm Dorothy Wickenden. On today's Politics and More podcast, New Yorker staff writers Patrick Radden Keefe and Sheila Kolhatkar discuss the Justice Department's problematic record in prosecuting white-collar criminals.
Staff writer Sheila Kolhatkar writes frequently about Wall Street and finance. Her colleague Patrick Radden Keefe also writes about business, but more often he covers shady business, drug trafficking and the like. Patrick reviewed a book called, we're going to have to bleep this for the radio, The Chicken Club, which argues that the Department of Justice has gotten awfully skittish about prosecuting people in finance. Not long ago, Patrick and Sheila sat down to talk about why nobody seems to go to jail for financial crimes anymore and how that's impacted the country.
So Patrick and I met several years ago in a federal courthouse not far from here. I believe it was 40 Foley Square. Does that sound right to you?
I think so. It seems right.
And if I'm remembering this correctly, I was going through security and you were right behind me.
Was I? I guess we spent a lot of time in the security line.
We did, but Patrick and I were both there covering this really high-profile insider trading trial of Matthew Martoma, a former hedge fund trader at SAC Capital.
This was a big insider trading trial in the Southern District of New York when Preet Bharara was the U.S. attorney, and there had been a whole series of these insider trading cases, and I actually felt like kind of an interloper because in that press box were all of these reporters from Bloomberg, the FT, the Times, Reuters, who seemed to all know each other because they'd covered one after another of these big insider trading cases.
Well, this case really was sort of the crowning case of his campaign against insider trading at hedge funds. And at that time, which was late 2013, early 2014, he was boasting this incredible record in insider trading prosecutions. I mean, at one point, it was over 80-0 guilty pleas and convictions. And this made his reputation, and this really sort of marked him as the enforcer of Wall Street. Why do you think there were so many insider trading prosecutions?
It was interesting because that was the first big piece that I'd written about white-collar crime. And to me, it seemed as though we were coming in on this real crusade against this very specific type of crime. But as I was reporting that story, I spoke to some people who essentially said, you know, it's great and all that he's prosecuting these insider trading cases, but this is kind of a sideshow. We had already had the financial crisis unfold, and there was evidence of all kinds of fraud and decidedly risky behavior on the part of the banking sector, which had had huge, just cataclysmic economic effects. And there were a lot of people I spoke with who said, again, there's no question that there are people who are guilty of insider trading, but the idea that this would take up such a disproportionate amount of prosecutorial resources is a little curious.
Well, this has been really widely criticized in terms of, you know, how the government handled the financial crisis.
So it's fascinating. I wrote an essay in the magazine about a book called The Chicken Club, Why the Justice Department Fails to Prosecute Executives by Jesse Eisinger, who's a reporter with ProPublica. And a big thrust of his argument is that the Justice Department may have pursued certain types of cases, insider trading cases, certainly Foreign Corrupt Practices Act is another area where there have been prosecutions of white-collar executives, but that when it came to the underlying causes of the financial crisis, the Justice Department essentially gave a pass to the big banks and to the white-collar executives who were responsible for getting us into this mess.
So this might be a good moment just to describe the anecdote that led to the title of this book, The Chicken Club. Can you tell us where that comes from?
Yeah, so it's a great story. James Comey, before he was the household name, James Comey, was the head of the U.S. Attorney's Office in the Southern District of New York. And Eisinger tells this story about how when Comey came in, he assembled the troops. He assembled a bunch of his young assistant U.S. attorneys to give them kind of a pep talk. He went around the room and he said, I want you all to tell me who here has never had an acquittal or a hung jury, who has a perfect record. And a bunch of these young attorneys kind of sit up and raise their hands because they're the go-getters. They're the gunners is what we would have called them in law school. And Comey says, you know, we have a name for you guys. We like to call you the Chicken Club.
Ooh, harsh.
And his suggestion there, right, is that these are people who are picking and choosing the cases that they make, and that if you're not at least occasionally getting an acquittal or a hung jury, then you're not being forward-leaning enough in terms of the types of cases you're prosecuting. I should say that I have a little bit of perspective on this, having gone to law school myself. He really kind of hones in on this aspect of the – almost the anthropology of the legal professionals out there who go to elite law schools and get jobs as federal prosecutors, which are plum jobs, confronted with two types of cases, say – an insider trading case where it may be really difficult to make the case, but the odds of you getting a conviction are relatively high, and a much more abstruse, complex case in which you're trying to prove individual criminal culpability on the part of executives who are dealing in these financial instruments that nobody really seems to have understood at all, that somebody who's had a lifetime in which they never got a B would shy away from the latter kind of case. What I wonder, though, Sheila, is maybe you could talk to us a little bit about some of the cases that they haven't actually charged.
Right. Well, so what the financial crisis revealed to the world was that many of these major banks had been granting mortgages that they should not have, falsifying documentation, giving huge loans to people who worked as bartenders. And then they were taking all those loans, bundling them up into securities, and then they were selling them to investors all over the world. Then when the housing market started to decline, all of that just sort of collapsed. And here we are years later. Yes, there were no charges brought against any senior level people at any of these firms. And it is stunning because many of those firms have paid billions of dollars in civil penalties. So clearly a decision was made at some point sort of to steer away from individual charges. How is it possible that a bank would demand that its shareholders pay $16 billion in fines to the government, yet there was not an individual at that bank who could be charged with committing a crime? It just defies logic. And you can contrast that with other white-collar cases in the past that were handled very differently. Now, one that comes to mind is Enron.
Yeah.
And the Enron case was a very complicated case that took years to build. There was a dedicated group of prosecutors and FBI agents who were put on that case. They didn't have anything else they were supposed to do. They were only working on that case, and they were given resources to really follow it. And they ultimately ended up convicting Ken Lay and Jeff Skilling, the CEO and chairman of the firm. And they did not have any email evidence where those guys were saying something stupid and self-incriminating in an email. The case was much more diffuse, but they had witnesses. And just by really working hard over a long period of time, they were able to build the case without the kind of evidence that I think people have become accustomed to seeing now, which is somebody...
Smoking gun.
An email where somebody says, I know this is a criminal act and I am engaging in it. Ha ha, we got away with it. They didn't have any of that. Yet they did manage to put these two top guys in jail. And that does not happen anymore.
Amazing. So listen, I'm gonna tell you a story then. So this is largely what we've been talking about, an account of failures by the Obama administration to crack down on Wall Street and on the big banks in the aftermath of the financial crisis, a financial crisis that hit the country hard. And just a few years later, we have the rise of Donald Trump and of Trumpism. And I think most people would agree that Trump was sort of borne along on a tide of frustration and resentment of precisely the types of elites who seem to have gotten away with it during the Obama years. So tell me about the return to accountability under the Trump administration.
I think one of the reasons Donald Trump got all of the support that he did was because he really campaigned against Wall Street to some extent. And he kept saying, I'm here for the forgotten men and women of America, the little people who are suffering while all the elites reap all the rewards of this economy. And I think those were very powerful arguments. Of course, what we've seen since then, as far as I can tell, is a total reversal. He's gone and installed folks from Goldman Sachs and various hedge funds into all the key decision-making roles when it comes to economic policy. There's a lot of irony there. I mean, this is just yet another way that Trump has betrayed, I think, his voters and some of the ideas that made him appealing to a lot of people who voted for him.
Yeah. I mean, I wonder if this stuff will catch up with him, with the administration, or whether we can expect any greater degree of accountability. It's fascinating because clearly you've outlined a pretty disastrous state of affairs, but I don't see the political preconditions for any real major changes. If anything, I feel as though we may double down on this kind of impunity.
Certainly the reporting I've done on this suggests that corporate crime, white-collar crime, seems to have dropped way down the list of priorities.
It's a good time to be a banker.
That was Patrick Radden-Keefe talking with Shila Kolhatkar.